Honey, I blew up the business.
So welcome to the podcast, Lisa Layton.
Thank you.
This is how we're going to start. Lisa is my accountant. And before you switch off, don't switch off. She's not a boring accountant. She's a fun, cool, joyful, great accountant.
Some may call me Crackers. Crackers accountant.
Crackers accountant. So Lisa is extremely accomplished. I'm going to embarrass her by listing her many accomplishments, but she's joint managing partner of a company called BHP, an accountancy firm, but they're one of the largest independent firms in the north of England, chartered accountants, with more than 350 staff, which is a lot of people, including 31 partners. And she whips them into shape alongside by her other joint managing partner. Exactly. They're ranked the second best accountancy firm to work for in the UK. So you need to up your game, Lisa.
No, I know. Should be number one.
Up your game. And top 100 Sunday Times best companies to work for. And what I find is really interesting is Lisa is sort of up there running this business, but also advising lots of companies, and including mine. And she's been at BHP for a grand total of, I think, 26 years?
Or it's
a
long time. 26, yeah. I was only four when I started here.
That's it. She was 4 years old and very, very early started in her career. She's also executive in residence at Sheffield Hallam University. And she's my accountant. I've mentioned it. But here's what I wanted to get Lisa onto the podcast is we were having a meeting, like a review meeting. BHP have a kind of 90-day review with their customers. So we were having our 90-day review. And I've got to tell you, I was having a really kind of difficult day. And I thought, oh, my God, 90 minutes, sat with the accountants already. Ugh. And I got into the meeting, and it was a fun, creative, joyful experience. Yeah, where we talked about the numbers, but we talked about a lot of great ideas. And it was very, like I would say, a great experience. And I thought, well, do you know what? That combination of accountancy and fun, you don't get that very often. And it's very much Lisa's, I would say, unique ability. So good for you and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. And that's why, thank you. That's very nice of you to list all of that. It sounds very grand, but I am, I still have to think why, but I am just a 5'5" girl from Walsall.
Well, you know, if you were 5'6", then or 5'7", then you speak the head. But actually, well, I'm going to kick off actually. So what brought a girl from Walsall, which is in the West Midlands, to the bright lights of Sheffield in South Yorkshire?
And just on that point, Walsall, the very first day I started at Sheffield Uni, a girl was on the telephone and she asked me, where are you from? And I said, Walsall. She said, Poland. No, not Poland. And yeah, I've had quite a few people ask me from Poland over the years. So what brought me here? Uni. So I am from a very small town in the West Midlands called Walsall. If anybody's been there, they will see that one of the reasons why I came was I didn't really have a lot to go back to Walsall for. It was quite close to Birmingham, but Sheffield was the bright lights for me. So what started it all off was I was 17 and doing my A-levels, and nobody in my family had ever been to uni before. So it was all a bit weird. And I look back on it now, given that I've got a 16-year-old that's about to look at universities and I will be going with her, and I think, flipping heck. I got on a train, I went to Nottingham, I went to Sheffield. I remember coming out of Sheffield train station and thinking, oh, there's lots of big buildings here, having no clue what to do. I saw a bus that had on the front halfway and I thought, oh, halfway to where? And then I got a bus up to Sheffield Uni and the rest is history, really. I came here in 91. Quite a meek and mild person, very, very shy. In fact, my colleagues and friends now think I make this bit up. I was a sort of person that would go to family do's and just sit on my nan's lap and not really talk to people. I'm an only child. I came here. I did a 3-year degree in accountancy. I absolutely had no idea what an accountant did. I wanted to do law. originally, and I thought I couldn't get the grades to get me into a law course, so I went for the second option, which was accountancy. And I actually got the grades to do law, but I thought, forget it, I'll stick with accountancy. I like numbers, I'll go and see what that's all about. So I did my 3-year degree, and I lived up at Sorby Hall on Enclifale Road. So it was this big, awful flats, block of flat type university residence. And I used to walk past BHP and I think, oh, that looks like a really nice place to work. And 3 years later, I joined here. And the rest is history, really. 26 years later, I've worked my way through the firm, doing lots of different things. And I'm now running it jointly with my colleague, Hamish Morrison, who's based in our Leeds office. So, yeah, it doesn't feel like 26 years, though. It does feel like yesterday.
Well, we'll dig into your 26 years worth of experience, because I think there's bound to be lots of interesting stuff in there. But I'm kind of curious, is Walsall quite a kind of working class town?
Yeah. So Walsall is very, very working class town. My dad was a carpenter. My mum worked in Sainsbury's, and then she worked in the hospital cleaning. So, you know, we weren't a wealthy family, but what we were and what my mum and dad drilled into me was working hard, get a good education, be open, be honest, and that's where it's really got me really to here, because when I was at secondary school stage, I took an entrance exam to go to the local grammar school, and I passed it. And I didn't want to go because it meant leaving friends. And particularly given what I said earlier about being quite shy, I didn't really want to do that. So I stuck to the local comp. I went to the local comp. And then when I did my A-levels, again, I was in that position where my mum and dad very much wanted me to go to uni. I don't think I really knew what uni was at the time, if I look back. Wanted me to go to uni, and I didn't particularly fancy leaving home. And I never forget now, my dad said to me, you had your way once. It was your decision to not go to grammar school. It is now not your decision to not go to uni. So you go in. And, you know, that was probably, there's probably two events in my life that really probably have driven where I am now. That was one. And that was very much, you know, there's no debate here. You go in, and it'll be really good for you to go to a city that's not, that you can live at home. And then the second event, was unfortunately my dad passed away 2 years into my, university. So I was just about to do my second year exams, and I had a phone call one day to say that my dad had had a heart attack and hadn't survived it. And I think that also gave me that resilience to actually continue to do what, well, I look back at that often, and I learned significant amounts, I would say, in that year. One was which, and I said earlier, I'm an only child. One was which, you know, I had to grow up very quickly, had to support my mum. Nobody teaches you how to arrange a funeral. Nobody teaches you about when somebody dies, there's things like probate. I had absolutely no clue what to do. So I think that probably forms a massive part of the Lisa of today. You know, seeing my mum at 46, losing her life partner, and seeing the resilience that she had, you know, to make me continue to, you know, she made me come back to uni. I resat my second year, but she, you know, she was very much an advocate of me coming back. At the time, there were certain family members of mine that said that it was wrong to come back. I should move back to Birmingham and live back with my mum, but I didn't. And my mum you know, pushed me to come back. And then when I got a job here, you know, she was very supportive of me staying in Sheffield, and she's continued to support me. And I would say I actually couldn't do what I do now without having my mum as my second in command. And she has been my second in command. She's been my confidant. She's been my childcare. She's been my food parcels. She's done my washing. I mean, at 48, she still brings me food parcels now.
We all need a food parcel from us, mum.
Oh, she does. She brings me them food parcels.
That's well. Listen, that's that. My mum does that actually. So yeah, shout out to the mums.
Yeah, definitely shout out to my mums. To the mums. My my daughter's 16, and I'm at that stage now where I worry if she goes anywhere. And my mum said to me, "You never stop worrying, you know. You're 48, and I still worry about you when you go out." And so my mum still lives in Walsall, but she visits every week. She still visits every week, other than the 12 or 14 weeks when she couldn't in the pandemic. And if I go out on a work do or a work meal or a dinner, I know for a fact she's not asleep when I get back in, because she wants to make sure that I've got back home.
Oh, my life. Well, there you go. Well, that's someone who's got your back.
It is. It very much is.
Bloody hell. Well, a couple of themes in there that I think I'm trying to, I'd like to focus on. One is around this, it's almost courage, right? So if you go back to, so you're this, I've got this picture of it. It's a working class town with a working class girl, a single child with a parents who are very supportive and are perhaps pushing you a bit, but you're shy. You're a bit reticent to sort of take that jump for the grammar school. So there's a sort of courage. So you kind of stuck with that one instance where you didn't go to grammar school. You stuck with your mates.
Yeah.
And you did that path. And the second thing was then going to uni. You were already pushed outside of your comfort zone there. And just reflecting on that now, looking back at that, did those two moments, how do you think that kind of, your dad gave you a push basically. How do you feel about that now, looking back?
Looking back, I hated it at the time. I said to my daughter last week, we drove past Encliffe Village, and I still remember to this day the place that they parked when they dropped me off and left me. And I cried, thinking they've abandoned me. But then pretty quickly, I made some really nice friends on the floor that I lived on. I made some really nice friends on my course. And very quickly, I got to the point where I didn't want to go home every week. And I think that's the same for most people, isn't it, when they first go to uni. But having quite a close-knit family, it was quite a big thing to do, to step out of that comfort zone and go. And I look back now, and actually, it's quite a proud moment to do that. Mm. But I don't think you don't realise that at the time. You don't realise how big a step that is.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? But even now, like back in the 90s, there was much more people for whom the university experience was a genuinely new experience for their family.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now it's like it's much more of a mass market thing. Yeah. I guess. Everyone goes to uni. But then it was like if you were working class, going to uni was a big thing that people hadn't done until the 90s.
Yeah. And I think it's now it's almost an expected, isn't it? It's almost a treadmill of schools that you do your GCSEs, you do your A-levels, and then you go on to uni to do a degree, and then you get a job. And I think if I knew now also what I know now from seeing people come through here, particularly given levels of debt that people get into for going to uni, I think that, the other option would be to go from school to come and do something like I do now. And, you know, I think more people should be aware of the fact that you don't have to go to uni. But I think saying that, the big thing that I got from uni was growing up.
Yeah, it's a funny one because I've got children of similar age to you, and my eldest is looking at unis right now. I mean, she's literally been, looking at different universities this week, and it's funny because in some ways, there's a lot of like the debt thing and all this kind of, like, what do you get out of it? But I look back at my university time now, and there's loads of things I've learned that, frankly, I wasn't aware of until 20 years later.
Yeah. Yeah. I think if I hadn't gone to uni, I reckon I wouldn't be doing something like I'm doing now. Even if I'd have stayed at home, I don't think I'd have had the guts to actually go out there and get a job. Even if it was in Birmingham, I think I'd have just stuck at home.
You were this kind of shrinking violet, you know, this kind of someone who didn't want to kind of get involved in social situations. You're very quiet, and then you kind of, so you, and you shrank away from the grammar school opportunity.
Yeah.
You know, for good reason, and I get it about staying with friends. But then you were forced, winkled out of your kind of little comfy existence in Walsall and spat out into the great outdoors. And so that's an interesting piece around courage and building on that and actually kind of embracing that. And I think the other bit I thought, just from your story, is interesting, is you could have quite easily perhaps gone back to that after your dad died. Yeah. And again, just could you speak on that, like the kind of culture of like, well, you should be coming back and perhaps you should be supporting your mum, or what are you doing at university anyway? You know, what's all that about? And you've got this, you're kind of leaving this kind of working class thing, going into a much more kind of, I call it middle class existence.
Yeah.
What was that like at the time?
It was really difficult because you were torn between, you know, you've got this responsibility that my mum was on her own. She'd been obviously been through trauma. You know, she was living on her own. Don't get me wrong, she was surrounded by a very supportive network of family and friends. But I'd still got this bit to finish off. I couldn't just, I don't like giving up on stuff. Despite me being quiet, I was very much into my education. I studied hard. I studied really hard for my A-levels. I've been given this opportunity to come and do a degree. I didn't want to not finish it. What I did do, though, was I had an option. So my dad died in the May, and I was due to take my exams 2 days after, and I didn't. And there was an opportunity for me to actually resit them in the August and stay and continue with a group of friends that I'd made on my course, but I didn't. I took the option of spending that summer at home with my mum, you know, because those first few months were very raw. And then I came back to uni and I resat the second year again because I didn't want to feel under pressure to go in and sit something I didn't feel comfortable with and I'd missed a year of. So I actually came back, and that was hard as well in the fourth year. So in my third year, obviously people were still here that I knew and I built relationships with, and then they all left. And then they all left again, and I had to find somewhere to live, and I had to make a whole new group of friends. But I think I learned so much. I didn't think I was learning anything at the time, but that period of when my dad died and having to support my mum and dealing with other stuff that wasn't just a normal thing that somebody would do at age 19 and continuing to come back here, I think, you know, it put me in really good stead around that. You know, people talk about resilience a lot. There's no one any more resilient in my life than my mum. She could have just said, right, that's it. That's it. I've lost everything here. But she didn't. She just continued to, you know, she continued with her life. She rebuilt her life. But we're very close. And since that day, she has come to Sheffield every single week, being my support network constantly. But, you know, as I grew and had my two kids, she came and she was, you know, spent a lot of time with her grandkids, and she still comes now. She's 75. I've asked her often to move here. If we could get her up here, that'd be massive. But she does it, and you know, she has got her own life and she's still got friends. So yeah, it's very much learnt a huge amount. I could have gone back, but I didn't. And you know, I take a lot from those years, which I also use with the team. You know, one of the things that in terms of the team is they come in front of, you know, they you know, people make mistakes and they come and see me and say, oh God, Lisa, I've done this. And my first question is, has anybody died? Because I go back to that, you know, that feeling that I had when I had that phone call, and I could never, ever be in a position where I felt that low. And, you know, if somebody makes a mistake, we can fix it. You can't bring somebody back. You just can't. So I use that often in my day-to-day life of there's nothing can be worse than that. We can fix it. We can fix this.
Yeah, well, it's very true. And it's funny because it's a great, excellent reframing exercise. You know, like the recontextualizing exercise. Yeah. You put it like, okay, really, has anybody died? And,
yeah.
You know, and you know, then everything above that is doable.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I say to the team here, they laugh at me. I say, right, are we brain surgeons? No. I'd love to think that we're saving lives, but we're not. We're doing accounts. We're giving people advice from a business perspective. You know, we're not brain surgeons. If we make a mistake, you know, it's fixable.
So this period, this kind of 2 year period, I think 2 or 3 year period, where your dad passes away, you have to resit. Well, you don't have to. You went back and sat the second year again. Then you had people leaving. The kind of mix with your kind of social circle and where you're going to live. So you said it was a kind of really rich experience of learning around resilience. Looking back now, what do you think the things you, how would you describe resilience? Because people talk about it. It's like, yeah, I was really resilient, or I learned resilience. But what is resilience?
I think for me, resilience is you feel in a particularly low position. It's picking yourself back up, and it's getting mechanisms that help you just get back on it, you know. And over the years, you know, from a personal perspective, you have really, you know, you have low points, and it's what do you do to help you get back on it. And particularly, you know, over the last 2 years, we've had to have a lot of resilience, haven't we? But I think the way that I cope with things is recognizing that you need help from somebody or something, that you ask for it and get that support network around you to actually get you through and out through the other side. It's picking yourself back up is what's in my head as resilience.
And could you give us an example of like where you've been able to do that, or the tools you've used to do that? And it's quite abstract, like picking yourself back up or resilience. And I get that's kind of what it is, but like, how does that work day to day for Lisa? You know, like if you kind of have to pick yourself back up again, how do you approach that?
Okay, I'll give you a couple of examples probably here. So the pandemic hit. Nobody obviously foresaw, well, people did foresee what was happening with that, but I didn't. I honestly thought that it would be this thing that came from China, we'd have a few sniffles and we'd carry on. And interestingly, I had a client who was very opposite scale to me. And in February, he said to me, this is going to be really bad. Can I come and see you now? And I need you to help me do some cash flows. And I told him he was crackers. I told him he was barmy. It would last a few weeks and that was it. But as a result of that, I put on our ops board agenda AOB, COVID. And all I meant by that was we need to put signs up to wash your hands, and we need to do things that are hygienic. Roll forward 2 weeks, and obviously the world turned very south. The whole life went up, our world went upside down. And I never forget sitting in our boardroom, and I will remember to this day the clothes I was wearing, and we'd had asked our FD to do some cash flow forecasts of, right, if we have no income coming in, and nobody knew at the time if we'd have income coming in, what would that look like? And he brought it up on the screen, and it basically said that by September we'd have no cash. And that was, you know, it was pretty harsh, as in no income coming in. But at that point, everybody thought there was no income. So what I mean by that resilience was, I had meltdown. So I came up to my desk. I cried. one of my other partners came in to see me and said, Lisa, it will be okay. It will be fine. And all I could think about was the 350 plus mortgages that had to be paid. It's like, what on earth are we going to do? And just talking it through with the person that came in at the time. I'd got Hamish, who's my other partner, joint managing partner. He also was part of the team that, you know, we can get through this. I'd got an ops board that we were also looking at, well, how, what can we do action-wise to actually get us through this? And I sat here and I take myself back to the point I said earlier. Nobody's dead in that situation. You can only do what's in your control. And I think I talk to myself often and I sit here and I say, right, can you control this? No. What can you control? And let's have a look at what can you control and let's move on here, because if you can't control it and you can't do anything about it, you're wasting energy even trying to. So I think that's a, I mean, all of these come back to, for me, it's tapping into who you've got around you to help you with it. Another example is probably 3-4 years ago, I had a minor meltdown. And what I mean by that was taking far too much on, not looking after myself, and just being exhausted. And I remember going home, again, crying. There's a theme here, isn't there? I do like a good cry. I find it helps. Went home crying, probably about 9:30 one evening, knowing that I'd got a load of work to do because I've got a meeting in the morning. I went into the house crying. My mum was there. My husband was there, who was also very supportive. And I said, right, what should we do? I said, just cook me tea and I'll carry on. I'll stay over here crying, but just ignore me. And it's that ability to constantly just come back to, right, what's the worst that can happen here? Well, the worst that can happen, Lisa, is probably you're going to make yourself really ill. So what are you going to do about it? And again, in that instance, you know, I had some very supportive partners that saw that I was just not focused. I was running very hard, not looking after myself. And I sat down with them the following day and said, right, what can we do to make your life better? And I took a hard look at myself, had a hard look at my diary, having a look at what I was doing. And I think that's the negative of what we talked about earlier around that positivity. And I like to help people. I like to solve problems, but sometimes that's at the detriment of yourself and your family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100%. That's the real risk, actually, because if you're a very empathic, compassionate, giving, caring person, then that's great. Until the boundary that perhaps is not unclear, until you have a kind of burnout issue, you go past that boundary and you're just giving away all of your energy and all of yourself.
Yeah.
And in effect, depleting the kind of reserves. So you end up melting down.
Yeah. And I think my husband thought I was crackers at that point, because I then said, right, I never did exercise ever. Well, I used to go to the gym a lot pre-children, but then I just couldn't fit it in. Mm. And I said, right, I'm going running. I think he thought I'd lost it. So I started running after that meltdown a few years ago. And that was such a game changer for me, because what I was constantly doing is working all day in the office, coming home, grabbing something to eat, carrying on working, and then having no separation or break. So I used to then, the big change that I did was I'd come home, I'd go for a run, and that just cleared my mind and put things back into perspective as well, so that if I did need to carry on working in the evening, then it was attacking it in a fresher way. And I've continued that. And, you know, I I'd never run. I did the couch to 5K, really enjoyed doing that. And then we sponsored the York 10K a few years. In fact, we've done it for a few years. And somebody said to me, are you going to join it? I'm like, there's no way I can run 10 kilometers. But I did it. And I felt such a sense of achievement that I've been able to run 10 kilometers, albeit my knees are a bit dodgy now. So I've now resorted to a Peloton,
well,
which I love.
Well, Peloton. I've heard lots of good write-up about Peloton, actually. So I'm considering getting one. But I guess it's really all that's really great and interesting and rich. Because what I love about you, Lisa, is you're kind of very straight talking and straight to it. But you've covered a couple of things there. One was the pandemic and the kind of facing imminent destruction thing, right? And then the other was your minor meltdown, which, you know, has been built out of habits and perhaps subconscious patterns of wanting to work hard and help people, and perhaps that's driven you to a point where you're making yourself unwell. But all of that's kind of like it's sort of, again, it's proving that point about resilience. But I think there's some, I think we've all gone through experiences, well, possibly all of us within the last year, where you're facing imminent destruction, or it could be, and you're facing feeling burnt out, and that separation of work and home, particularly when people are working from home. What do you think you've learned from all of that? Just like take a step back and look at it now and go like, okay, we've talked about early stage building resilience. We've got this kind of more recent stuff happening. What do you think you've learned from that in terms of practical tools that an entrepreneur or a business owner can learn from?
I think the biggest learning point, and everybody says it all the time, and you never really, I don't think you realize it until you've had that burnout, is make time for yourself, because I find making time for myself, I feel that that's quite selfish when you actually shouldn't. So I think it's making sure, I would say it's making sure you put yourself before you actually put others first. And I'm not saying, right, no, I'm not going to do that because I'm putting myself first. I think it's really recognizing when you are knackered. And I think one of the things that, you know, we've all run really hard, haven't we? We've run through brick walls for the last 18 months, but you can't keep going. And I think one of the things that I really try very hard with is I used to work most weekends. And what I mean by work most weekends is probably two full shifts, Saturday and Sunday. I try to work really, really hard to make sure at least one of those days I do nothing. I might check into a few emails here and there on the second day, but I make sure I try and do nothing. Albeit what that does mean is that I'm the family Uber for the weekend. But that's quite nice to be family Uber, because actually it's time that you're spending with one of the kids talking about what they've done in the week, or they open up about what they're doing at school. Because I mean, that's quite hard, isn't it? Having a conversation with a kid about what you're doing at school because they say nothing. And I think the other thing is making sure that exercise, I think, is massive. If my fellow partners are listening to this, they'll laugh at this one. I'm not very good with alcohol. I never have been. I only have, as one of my partners says, oh, don't give her more than one. She gets a bit giggly. but what it does mean is I feel really ill. So if I go back to last January, I quit drinking. And everybody's like, you've quit drinking. I said, well, it's easy because I can only handle one anyway. But I don't particularly drink a lot because I just find that I just don't sleep. And I think sleep is massive for me. If I don't, I mean, again, people laugh at this. If I go to bed beyond 10 o'clock, flipping heck, I'm useless. So for me, it's sleep, look after yourself in terms of exercise, eat well, drink well, and take time to do the things you enjoy, because again, coming back to what I said earlier, my mum and dad didn't enjoy any time together in retirement. And I think you can forget that. You can forget that you need to take time to enjoy stuff because we're only here once.
Yeah.
No point having on your grave.
Wow.
Really enjoyed it at work for 60 hours a week.
Wow, that's a great shout. And it's something that I've guilty of this is it's like you get so focused on work and then to, again, if you're into it and actually you enjoy it and you feel a great sense of responsibility, be it to your team or to the success of the company or to yourself or whatever, or your family. And then you kind of like, then you find you're not speaking to your kids and your kids are not communicative. I mean, I've had this with my wife where we're like ships in the night. Like she's perhaps doing the Uber and I'm doing the recording the podcast or whatever. And suddenly you realize you haven't spoken to each other apart from like a cursory, do you want some food? Like every now and then. It's something that particularly after this week, for what it's worth, I'm really trying to remind myself to do things that are just for their own sake that I find enjoyable for fun, playful thing.
Yes.
And that's enough of an excuse to find the time and the resources to do it, whatever that is.
And I also think a big positive of the pandemic is around that flexibility. So, for example, today, so I'm in the office this morning and then I've got a late meeting that starts at 5, probably won't finish till 7. And ordinarily, I would have stayed here and been late back to see the kids. But actually, I'm going to go home at lunchtime, set up at home. And actually, once that meeting's finished, you've created time to spend time with the family. And I think the other thing that I've tried to work hard at is I mentioned this Peloton earlier. I make sure that I find time to get myself on that bike most days. I've just joined a challenge that, our bank manager has got a Peloton, which is why I bought it, because I was jealous that he got one. I saw him having it delivered in the bank review, in our bank review meeting. So the next day I bought one. And he's got me hooked up to this challenge. And you're in a team. And if you don't do your rides, you let your team down. And that for me is something that drives me, because I never want to be in a position where I'm letting somebody else down. Albeit, so I'm on week 3 of this, and week 1 and 2 I achieved platinum, and I was so disappointed my team only achieved silver. So
oof, you need to have a word with them. I mean, well, there's something to that, accountability and fitness and actually getting on it, and whatever motivates you to do it, then that's how you get the habit.
Yeah,
you
know what
I mean? There's a great book called Atomic Habits, which is about building new habits, and atomic as in small, and you start small. But this, in that, he talks a lot about accountability, and you know, you create a contract with someone and or do it publicly, or do you know, there's a downside if you don't do it, basically. Yeah. Because, you know, like, so for you, it's the loss of perhaps feeling of responsibility or loss of face or whatever that would be, or the sense of support you've given to the team. And I think there's something really in that, because I have that, where it's like, actually, to kick my behind to get to do something, I need to have kind of created a framework in which I can't get out of it.
Yeah. If somebody gives me, so if I have a task to do and I'm accountable and I have to go to a meeting to report back, for example, on progress that I've made, I never ever want to be in a position where I go into that meeting and I'm the only one that's not done anything.
Yeah, well, there you go. So actually reporting on it means that it actually gets done.
Yeah.
There's that Peter Drucker quote, isn't it? What gets measured gets managed.
Yeah.
And I think there's this, yeah, so all that good stuff. One thing before we were sort of edging towards our sort of time together, but I wanted to ask you just more broadly. So we've gone into your story and some stuff around like issues or things you've been confronting within the business in the last few years. But I'm because you're speaking to a lot of other business owners, I mean, people like me.
Yeah.
And you've been out there, not only facing up to the possible downside for your own company, but you're looking, I guess you're this person that I, for example, would want to get confidence from. Like I'd phone you up and go, hey, my cash flow, what about this? How am I going to get some funding? So what have you seen just in terms of what are the patterns? What are the big issues that people are facing? And what are the big lessons from the pandemic from your perspective as a speaking to lots of business owners?
Yeah, I mean, I I always say this to my kids, that I, you know, I'm in such a privileged position to do the role that I do, because I can be the world's nosiest person about businesses and ask legitimately how people are doing. So I am, I feel extremely privileged to know lots of stuff about lots of businesses, and it helps me in two ways. One, I bring really good ideas. It allows you to bring good ideas back into your own business, but also to spread those, you know, the good things that people do. I mean, I never betray any confidences, but you see some really good stuff that people are doing to share. And I would say the things that I am currently seeing is there is, and across the last 18 months, is a huge amount of people collaborating and working together. And what, you know, a good example of that is primarily around cash. So I bang on about cash to my clients all the time, because that, you know, if there's one thing that I would say to anybody setting up business or in business, is never, ever ignore cash. Profit and loss is brilliant, but cash is the, you know, it's an old thing that cash is king. I hate, absolutely hate that terminology, but it really is. So what I'm seeing is a huge amount of collaboration around businesses. So, you know, in the early days, one of the things that we did is make sure that we paid people promptly, on time. And that actually was what happened with our clients as well. They paid us promptly, on time, because we were all in it together. So what I'm seeing across the board is people continuing to work hard at that working capital. So a real focus on cash more than ever before. You know, collect your debtors in and make sure that you're doing stuff, working with people that you want to work with. I think that's the other thing I've seen, is people being very, very selective on who they want to work with, and making sure that commercially it stacks up. You know, there's no point working for people if they're not going to pay you in the moment all the time. And I'm seeing that in lots of industries.
That's interesting. You have said to me, and I don't know if you want to share this on the podcast, have a particular a phrase or a name of people you would like not to work with.
Yeah. I've come back to this, life's too short to be working with N star star heads.
Knobheads.
Yes.
Yay, we said it. I wanted you to get you to say it. You said the
people, you know, there's worse. We say worse down in Walsall. Worse right, words than that.
Well, we have the edited polite Walsall version. Well, I love that, by the way. You don't want to work with knobheads. And listen, with the greatest respect to all the people out there, some people are better suited to work with other people than others, right?
Absolutely. But what I want to do is, you know, you said at the outset that people have a dim view of an accountant. They think we're boring. But actually, I want clients to want to look forward to have a meeting with me, because it's you know, it's dry, some of this stuff, and it's really important stuff, but actually you need to want to work with somebody. And I think if we can, you know, I am straight talking, there's no point dancing around handbags. It's having that open and honest relationship with your client and your team to enable you to do that. And I think, you know, if more people did that, I think it'd be much enjoyable relationship to have with an accountant.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think that's a really good shout, because I think there's a bit of a thing here where the problem with, I'm not going to say problem with accountants, problem with a lot of business, and particularly professional services businesses like law and accountancy and insurance, or like kind of financial services perhaps, is there's this persona they feel they have to put on.
Yeah, and I think that's not helped by the fact that, you know, nobody teaches you to do this other stuff. People, you know, you go into in the accountancy profession or the law profession and you do your professional exams, and it's teaching you accounting, it's teaching you tax, which, you know, is quite dry because it's very rules driven. But that's not why clients want to work with you.
People buy from people, you know, yeah. And I think part of what's interesting about what you said here, and I think that's actually quite an important takeaway for people, is the more you can be,
yes,
whatever the discipline is, whether it's accountancy or technology,
whatever, marketing, the more uniquely you are, the weird, quirky, interesting version of you, and the more authentic you can be true to that, the better it is for your business.
Yeah.
Because you're not this like generic cookie cutter, polite accountant. You're actually Lisa, who's got a bit of an attitude and some fun. And that's just more a better vibe for me as a business owner who want to work with somebody.
And I think, you know, across the years, you know, we will have had ups and downs and tried things out within the business that just don't work. And if I can sit in front of a client and say, oh, I wouldn't try that if I were you, because when we did this, this happened. Or, oh, yeah, try it this way. You know, I get a real buzz from being in meetings, talking to clients and listening to what challenges are and trying to bring some solutions to it. Mm. Don't get me wrong, we do an audit findings report as well, which is a thrill a minute. But, you know, for me, it's around those conversations. And, you know, I keep coming back to the kids, but my son is 12 and he said to me, oh God, your accountant's really boring. Anyway, we saw a client of ours, my son's obsessed with cars, saw a client of ours at M&S, and this client of ours loves cars. So he started to have a conversation with Stan about his cars and all these high-end supercars that he's got. And we got in the car and my son said to me, he said, is that that client, what do you do for them? I said, well, it's not a client of mine. It's one of my fellow partners, but they'll do this, this and this. I said, but that's like what a client that I've got. I'll have a meeting with them and I'll just talk. I said, what I do is talk. Mm. My job is talking and I love it. Oh, you're not as boring as I thought. I thought you just did numbers. Well, if you talk to people that have got cars like that, I think an accounting job sounds quite good.
Hey, there you go. Well, finally, you've persuaded the kids that you're not a complete dork. So you've managed to pull it out of the bag. That's fantastic. Well, yeah, still my kids think I'm a total loser. So it doesn't matter what you're doing. No matter how accomplished you may or may not be, unless you've like got a YouTube channel with a million subscribers. No good for a teenager.
Yeah.
Well, we're wrapping up towards the end of our time on the podcast. I mean, Lisa, thank you so much for sharing. You've been extremely open about your personal life and how that's kind of impacted your career. And there's a whole lot of really interesting and good, useful stuff in there. So if we were going to find more about you, where should people go and have a look?
So have a Google me. You will find me on www.bhp.co.uk and LinkedIn. So I do share things on LinkedIn and I try and share not boring stuff.
There we go. We'll put all those links in the show notes and you'll get the not boring stuff direct from Lisa's LinkedIn. And so thank you for joining us. And I'll see you, I'm sure, very soon, because we do work together. So thanks, and I'll see everybody next time. Do you want to get the top 5 tidbits from each episode emailed to your inbox every Friday? Yes, you do. It saves you having to go through and make notes and make a note of all the books and all the ideas that are in the podcast. We go through and we choose the top 5 we like, plus put all the links into that email. So if you just go up to honeyibluupthebusiness.com, yes, that's honeyibluupthebusiness.com, and just enter your email address. There's a little box, just enter it in, and we will send you that information. And it saves you having to make notes and all that. That's make your life a bit easier. And of course, if you did enjoy the episode, please consider subscribing. We are trying to help people through this. So the more people that subscribe, review, rate on Apple, Google Podcasts, Spotify, the more people will see it and the more we can help. So help us help other people, other entrepreneurs like you. And before I go, I've got to say big up to my company, the tech department, the company we blew up and put back together again. They're generously supporting me on this mission through the podcast. So if you guys want to have a look at a company that can really help you improve your technology, make it better so your business gets better too, boosting your sales and your profit and a bit more sanity in your life, a little less stress, then head up to thetechdept.com, the tech department. My company, give us a look. On behalf of all of us here, thank you for listening and I'll see you next time.